and they go through parliament in groups of 30. Rarely do all MPs get their bill debated. Each private member's bill goes through first and second readings, committee stage, reporting stage, a third reading, then onto the Senate to follow the same process. And finally, royal assent makes it law. This year, lottery number 21 was for NDP MP Jenny Kwan of Vancouver East. Her proposed bill C233, the No More Loopholes Act, was debated for the first time on November 19th.
Requirement that we do not contribute our weaponry, parts, and components in atrocities, in committing genocide and crimes against humanity, Mr. Speaker. I don't think Canadians want blood on their hands, and this is what it means. And so if they
don't... Jenny Kwan's Bill C233, the No More Loopholes Act, is designed to close the legal gaps that have allowed Canadian-made weapons, parts, and components that have reached conflict zones unchecked. It defines military goods to include all parts, components, and technology. Exports are banned to places where weapons could be used for genocide, crimes against humanity, or attacks on civilians. No exemptions, even the US. Exporters must provide end-use certificates from the receiving country, confirming weapons won't be misused. This bill ensures Canada can't hide behind loopholes, exceptions, and omissions while its arms fuel conflict and genocide. Her legislation forces transparency, accountability, and alignment with Canadian and international law. That's exactly why Carney's government doesn't want to pass it.
And so for all those reasons, I'm announcing today that Canada will achieve NATO's 2% of GDP target this year, half a decade ahead of schedule.
Carney's economic plan is based on capitalizing on the weapons trade, and he doesn't appear to really care much about human rights. Those are just externalities to his balance sheets. Canada's role in the genocide is not just political, it's material. Weapons, parts, and components were actively used by Israel in the genocide through legal loopholes, undermining both Canadian law and international obligations. Jenny Kwan's No More Loophole Act is a chance to close these gaps, increase transparency, and ensure Canada is held accountable for the human impact of its exports. If these gaps persist, who knows where it will lead next, and which human rights abuses or genocides Canada could be arming. This isn't just about foreign policy. It's about Canada's moral integrity at home and abroad. In late February 2026, members of Parliament will vote on whether to accept Bill C-233, the No More Loopholes Act. If you believe that Canada's military exports to the US should be independent of US global imperial interests and foreign policy, governed by real transparency, monitoring, and permit oversight, and fully compliant with international law, take action. Email your Member of Parliament using the first link in the description. Your voice genuinely matters in this vote and can make a difference. If you found this documentary informative, consider donating to Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. CGPME is a human rights and advocacy organization fully funded by Canadians. Your support makes these documentaries possible.
There's a new episode of Palestine Debrief. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at cjpme.org and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by the Canadian progressive journalism community, unrig.ca. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2016, Green Planet Monitor features news and stories on global environment, development, science, and social justice issues hosted by longtime public radio journalist David Kattenberg in Hamilton. On this highlight from a new episode, University of Toronto Department of Nutritional Sciences Professor Emeritus Valerie Tarasuk joins the show to discuss PROOF, a research program exploring policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada. Now, here's David.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, food insecurity in Canada. It is widespread. And Eugene Debs, trailblazing American Union leader and socialist radical, inspiration for New York City's new Democratic Socialist mayor, Zohran Mamdani, and for democratic socialists up, down, and across North America. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg.
Mm-hmm.
up on Kylie's report, one in four Canadians live in households experiencing food insecurity. That's the finding of a report from Statistics Canada released last November. Over the last 5 years, the rate of severe food insecurity, Canadians actually not eating, has doubled. Food insecurity is highest in Nunavut. 60 to 70% of households there experience it. It's the lowest in Quebec. For insight into the nature and origin of food insecurity in Canada, the GPM reached out to Valerie Tarasuk, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto. Tarasuk is the coordinator of PROOF, a research program that explores policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada. Can you talk about this? What is the status of food insecurity in Canada? To what degree do we see food insecurity and hunger in Canada? Is it comparable to the United States? Not that the United States is just an interesting benchmark because they're south of the border. What's the status of food insecurity in Canada?
So a couple of things to say. First of all, while we use the same metric, we use the same questionnaire to assess food insecurity in Canada as they do in the United States, but we code the questions differently. So the statistics on food insecurity is quite tricky, right? Because they look like they're all telling you the same thing. This is the number of people who are food insecure. But because of these subtle differences in the way that different countries handle the actual coding and interpretation of that measurement, we end up with different results. So we can't compare directly the percentages that you've cited from the US with those from Canada because we're using the codes differently. So to explain a bit more about what I'm meaning, back in the 90s, the United States Department of Agriculture developed a very thoughtful, very clever measure of food insecurity. It's 18 questions that range in severity from worrying about running out of food and not having money to buy more, through to compromises in the quality of what adults eat or the quality of what children eat, and then through to a whole bunch of questions about quantitative deprivation. So people skipping meals, going hungry without eating, going whole days without eating at most extreme cases, all because of a lack of money for food. So 18 questions. And those questions are brilliant from a measurement perspective because they're designed to assess food insecurity almost like a thermometer. So with each additional affirmative answer on those 18, we know that the household is in a more severe condition, right?
And so the idea is that food insecurity depends on how you define food insecurity, but it kind of exists across a very wide spectrum.
That's right. And there's a continuum of severity. And from a health and well-being perspective, obviously those who are in more extreme conditions are in worse shape. Okay, so that's the measurement tool. Imagine, 18 points on a yardstick, and when it was first developed, it was developed in the United States, and it from the get-go was of interest because of the links between the levels of food insecurity in the country and the success or the efficiency of the publicly funded food assistance programs in that country. So SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Program that used to be called food stamps, but also things like WIC and other initiatives that were designed to provide nutrition to vulnerable groups in the population. Okay, so you have a choice with those 18 questions. At what point do you claim someone's food insecure? Do you say any answer is an indication, or do you need them to answer two or three? And so the U.S., wanting a conservative measure because, this is a terrible problem and you don't want the problem to appear bigger than it really is. So from the beginning, the U.S., insisted that people have at least two or more, possibly three or more affirmatives before they were considered food insecure. Over time in Canada, we came to understand that if you said yes to any one of those questions, you were different than somebody who said no to all of them. And even somebody who said they were worrying about running out of food before they had money for more was different than someone like me who would never say yes to that because I wouldn't worry about that. So in Canada, we started counting anybody who said anything yes. So Then we started to, you know, when Canada adopted the module, we adopted it in 2005, so a long time ago. But we started then also to rethink the coding of the module and how the questions about children were handled versus adults. So, you know, it's like any area of science, right? Over time, things have evolved in terms of the measurement. But the U.S. their public releases have kept with a very conservative estimate of food insecurity. And they've done that for obvious reasons. Whereas in Canada, because our measurement of food insecurity sadly isn't tied to any political decisions, we've been less worried about a conservative estimate. So over time, in the beginning, when Canada first started using this module, the prevalence of food insecurity in Canada, when we would take the data from both countries and reanalyze it using comparative metrics so that we had actual, you know, we were comparing apples with apples. When we did that in the beginning, Canada looked way better. Prevalence of food insecurity that was, I don't know, half or two-thirds that of the U.S. So we looked like we were doing way better. That's not true anymore. The most recent year that we did a calculation of the comparable numbers was, I think, 2022, and we're neck and neck. So the situation in Canada has gotten worse. We are not doing better than the United States. We're also not doing worse. It looks like the two countries are very comparable right now.
And that number was in 2022 was 17.8% of those surveyed, or of the country, faced some degree of food insecurity.
And I can give you a number that it dates to 2024, so a more recent number, because the rate has increased considerably. In 2024, 25.5% of Canadians lived in a household that experienced some level of food insecurity. 25%. So we've seen a dramatic rise over the last few years.
And that would range from worries that you're not going to have enough money in your bank account to buy food at the end of the month or at the very beginning of the month after you've paid your rent versus people who are actually skipping meals and they're hungry.
That's right. And all of those conditions have gone up. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a doubling in the number of people living in severe food insecurity. Severe food insecurity are people who said yes to enough of those 18 questions that we've reason to believe people in those households actually went without eating because of a lack of food and money for food. So yeah, this is a very dire situation.
So I want to ask why. Why is this the situation, which is a complex question to answer? But the other question is, how widely distributed is this? Do we see this evenly distributed across Canada, or is it, you know, focalized in inner cities or in rural areas? How widespread and how evenly distributed is food insecurity, and why is there food insecurity? And I mean, you could talk for 2 hours about this.
That's right. It's every province, every part of every territory, every part of this country has substantial rates of food insecurity. So no place is immune from this. Over the years that this problem has been measured, the rates are highest in Nunavut, much, much higher there. Depending on which survey you look at, you could see rates as high as 60 or 70%. So over half of the population in Nunavut appears to be living in food insecure situations. And so that is the extreme, you know, worst picture in the country. But it's like tragic, right? Because from the very beginning, when this survey started back in 2005, when they started surveying people in Nunavut, they were always finding much, much higher. I say they, these surveys are conducted by Statistics Canada. Always there were much, much higher rates of food insecurity in Nunavut. And what's happened over the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, those numbers have gotten worse. So that's the worst situation. The best situation, for the last few years, we've noticed lower rates of food insecurity in Quebec. And that's been interesting because in the beginning, Quebec didn't really distinguish itself from Ontario, for example. But in the last few years, Quebec has looked distinctly different. The suspicion is that we've got different social policies in Quebec compared to other places. And I think that makes good sense, right? I told you that over the country as a whole, the proportion of people living in food insecure situations was 25.5%. So in Ontario, it was 26.4. In Quebec, it was 19.8. Oh. So what have we got there? Like a 6-7 percentage point gap. That's illustrative of the contrast with Quebec. That there's this, as you know, Quebec is hardly doing well, right, at 19, what, almost 20%, but still substantially better than Ontario. How come? Well, I have a very, very talented research associate working with me who is originally from Quebec, Andréanne Fafard-Saint-Germain, and she has recently done a study trying to figure this out, comparing Ontario and Quebec over time to say what's going on. And what she's, and so that paper is coming out. It isn't out in the public domain yet. But what she's found is that there's no one thing. It's not like if we look at the difference between Ontario and Quebec, it's all about single parents, or it's all about single people, or it's, you know, we're not seeing that. It looks like it's across the board. And the implication is that there are an array of social policies in Quebec that insulate people from food insecurity. We know they have more generous child care policies, they have more generous child benefits, they have a lower cost of living. Part of what's been, I think, driving a lot of the really dramatic increase in the number over the last few years has been inflation and the cost of basic needs. And in Quebec, the cost of basic goods and services is on average lower than it is, for example, in Ontario.
Those David Kattenberg's Green Planet Monitor. Find the show archives at greenplanetmonitor.net, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Harbinger Executive Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, broadcasting since June 2023, Cyborg Goddess is a feminist tech studies podcast exploring topics like birth control, dating apps, gender confirmation surgery, and video games with host Dr. Jill Fellows on Vancouver Island. On the segment from a new episode, Dr. Fellows sits down with Dr. Julie Carpenter for a conversation exploring how our interactions with robots may already be changing our sense of ourselves and our place in the world. Now, here's the show.
So let's talk robots. Once the stuff of science fiction, now ubiquitous. And whether they are designed to resemble us and be as human-like as possible or not, there's one thing that seems certain. Even the most highly trained among us are susceptible to forming strong emotional bonds with their robots, and grieving the loss of their robots should it become damaged or destroyed. Given this, today I am joined by Dr. Julie Carpenter to talk about our relationships with robots and something she calls the human gaze. Dr. Julie Carpenter is a social scientist who studies the interactions between humans and various forms of AI technology. She is specifically interested in how AI technology affects our social relations and our sense of ourselves, and by extension, how the changes in our social relationships and sense of identity in turn influence the AI tools that we use and interact with. Her most recent book, The Naked Android, came out in 2025, and I cannot wait to talk to her about it and about her current research. So, hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me on and inviting me.
Thank you so much for being here. I've been following your work since I read your 2016 book, and I'm so excited.
Thank you. I really appreciate that you've read my books.
I will link both books in the show notes, and I highly recommend people check them out or get their libraries to order them. Interlibrary loan is also fabulous. So I want to begin by recognizing that digital space is physical, both in terms of the data centers, cables, and other infrastructure that sustains digital space, but also in terms of the resource extraction needed to power, grow, and maintain this space. This means that digital space has a direct impact on the land and on people who call that land home. So with that in mind, I acknowledge that this podcast is recorded on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, including the territories of the Katsi, Kwantlen, Kwikwetlem, Musqueam, Kikite, Squamish, Tsuwassen, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. And Julie, can you share where you're located today?
Yeah, I'm in San Francisco, and I want to respectfully acknowledge the Indigenous people who have stewarded this land throughout the generations.
Okay, so like I said, I read your 2016 book about human-robot interactions. I didn't read it in 2016, unfortunately. I wish I'd found it then, but I read it a few years ago. And you looked at human-robot interactions specifically in the military. Mm-hmm. And one thing I found super interesting in this book was how the robots were treated by the military squads that the robots were kind of working with, being used by. Mm-hmm. Like military personnel would give robots names and the bots might end up occupying kind of a space between mascot and pet. Yeah. And I wondered if you could talk about how that research came about and what were some of your big findings from that?
So the military is often one of the first places to develop and invest heavily in emerging technologies that they think will be valuable to them, right? And in war fighting in some way. And so I thought for a long time that this might be a setting worth exploring. Then it so happened that I met somebody who worked at a base that has explosive ordnance disposal personnel, or EOD. And this specific mission of service or job within the military, they're the people who try to keep people safe from any sort of explosive or incendiary device, whether that's chemical, nuclear, improvised explosive devices, mines, whatever they are. And this friend of mine said, it's EOD who have been working with robots as closely for like decades now, literally like the last 20 years. And they're the group that's been most heavily interacted with them that he was aware of. And so he was sort of my entree into that world. And I'm not military, so it was sort of some work as an ethnographer getting into that space. But once I did, I was really embraced, frankly.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, by the community who saw that I was there to really do research that might even be helpful to them, right? And it wasn't a critical look at the military. It was a look at how they're interacting with the robots and that I didn't want sensitive information and things like that.
Right.
And it's a fairly close-knit group, and that's an important part of the findings. And when I say close-knit group, and I'm talking about the time of 2016, I want to place that in that time, because since then, I know that they've been heavily recruiting a lot more EOD, so it might not be as close-knit a group, but it's a relatively small group. The U.S. military doesn't release exact numbers, but let's say around 5,000 people may be active at the time. So they also, what's interesting is EOD goes across all branches, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. And even though the context in which they work are very different and their training might eventually be very different. For example, Army will work on land. Air Force might work on things air-oriented, right? Navy does in a very extended training about underwater, making people safe from bombs and mines and things underwater. That's a whole different set of training. But what's interesting is that all the branches go through what's called colloquially the schoolhouse. And so at some point, they all have this touchstone for their training, which is unusual across the divisions of the forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, to have that basis of understanding. And I'm going to say fraternity, even though that's a sort of a brotherhood thing, but the idea of brotherhood and fraternity are very important to the social structure of EOD. And I think that's important to understand. It's a relatively, for social scientists anyway, it's sort of a closed group within a closed group,
right,
in a lot of ways. They're also in a weird space that they go through very rigorous intellectual book and paper training and ongoing training, and as well as physical training. But then they're also very good verbal communicators by the nature of their work. They have to be, because when you're trying to mitigate an explosive situation, literally, they have to be in constant communication with their team members. So that worked out well for me interviewing them.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So that was sort of an unanticipated bonus,
yeah,
for me too. And they were very helpful in helping me find other people to talk to. So besides the 22 EOD that I interviewed in depth in the book, I spoke to others in person in the different bases to get basic background information. I did archival research. If you read the book, you'll see I have pictures of PowerPoints available to the public with a lot of digging, a lot of archival research about military robots with pictures of some of the older robots used. But some of the findings were, as you said, that I think for me, the biggest, for me as a researcher, one of the most interesting things, especially at that time, because this was, like you said, 2016 when this research came out, was that space where these people who are highly trained, and let me clarify, these robots don't look human-like, and they're not meant to be social, because a lot of times when people say robot, what comes into your head is like a science fiction version of
like a
C-3PO. Right, exactly.
It was a highlight from a new episode of Cyborg Goddess. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your Canadian news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Instagram and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. We've all heard about the early bird getting the worm. We know it as sound advice about initiative and timely action. And we can almost see that robin leaning back and tugging that recalcitrant worm out of the ground. Research shows, however, that birds dining early and heavily may lower their life expectancy. A study of three North American woodland bird species found that socially dominant birds stay lean during the day and then stoke up when it's most important, later in the day, before a cold night. At night, birds avoid hypothermia by metabolizing fat. And by staying lean through most of the day, dominant birds are more agile in avoiding predators. Subordinate birds have to look for food whenever and wherever they can find it, and carry fat on their bodies to hedge against unpredictable rations. Dominant birds, which can push subordinates off food, can choose when they eat, and so lessen their odds of being eaten themselves. Therefore, at least in the woodland birds world, the revised moral might read, get the worm late in the day. You'll sleep better and live longer. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note is grateful to all listeners that provide financial support for this show. You can join them at birdnote.org.